My friends, how do you do? I'd like this time to talk about several things that pose a threat to a lot of people, and those especially to some alcoholics who are entering recovery, and even to some alcoholics who have been well for a lot of years. The whole phenomenon of spirituality and religion. It's a problem to many, and as I just said, it is a threat to many, for many, many reasons. Now, as all of you are well aware, I happen to be a Catholic priest. But don't let that run you off, because I do not intend to talk Catholic theology at all. The only thing I want to do will just share with you a few thoughts about spirituality in general and religion in general that I have picked up over the years. We speak so often of the spiritual life, and we speak so often of religion and religions. In the world of AA, especially, you hear the statement that AA is a spiritual way of life that is not a religion. And that is true. That's perfectly true. I think also, however, that that statement gives rise in the hearts and the minds of many recovered alcoholics the fact that they are somehow diametrically opposed, that spirituality is on one side of the fence and that religion is on the other. Well, I personally, and there are many like me who do not believe that at all, they believe that one is the fulfillment of the other. So, right now, let's just go into a few basic notions about this so aptly named spiritual life. Basically, the spiritual life refers to the non-physical life of man. The non-physical life of man, the life of his soul, or the life of his spirit. Now, everybody on earth who hears those words, soul and spirit, everybody has his own special definition of what they mean. The word soul, somehow, we associate with God. I don't know why, but, well, I do know why, but automatically we associate the word soul with God. And spirit as a kind of a very nebulous, mysterious thing. Well, let's just begin at the beginning and say that man is composed of body and soul. In other words, there is a physical, material part of man, his body that we see and feel and hear and touch and so on, the flesh and the bones and the hair and the skin. That is one part of man. But there's another part of man that is able to think, to feel, and to will, or to love. Now, it is that part of man that is non-physical. You can't see the soul. You can't measure it. In order to illustrate, I will use this example. We all know the difference between a live person and a dead person. And the difference is that in the live person, there is a principle of life. That's the soul. That's the soul. Now, let's go into the words. The word spiritual comes from a Latin word, spiritus, which means a sigh. For example, a sigh or a breath or a breathing, we use the word aspiration, which means breathing. We speak of the aspirations of the soul, the sighs of love, with which we reach out for God and so on. To aspirate is to breathe. Okay, that comes from this Latin word, spiritus. And the English word is obvious, spirit. The non-physical, this breath or sigh of life. All right? The Latins also have another word for soul. It's called anima. Now, this is a word that is known to everybody because it gives birth to words like animation, to animate, animated cartoon, and the very word animal. Remember the difference between a live person and a dead person, the difference between a live dog and a dead dog. The principle of life we call the anima, and anything that is alive is an animal. Now, even though we have made it very specific, dogs and cats and lions and tigers and so on, the word animal is very generic, and it applies to anything that's living. A blade of grass, a dog, a man, or, for those of us who believe in them, the angelic nature. Anything that is living has an anima, or a spirit that animates it, that gives it life and makes it alive. That's what we call an animal. All right. Now, please, the Greek word for soul is psyche, P-S-U-Y, C-K-S-C-H-E, psyche. Now, when we transfer that to English, we have psyche. And the study of the soul or the psyche is psychology, the study of the soul. Of course, when we bring the Greek word psyche into English, we do not pronounce that P. The P in psychology is silent like the P in swimming. All right. Psychology is the study of the non-physical part of man. That part in him which can know, which can feel, and which can will or love. Now, the soul is a unit. It is non-divisible. It is not made up of material parts. So it is non-divisible. But because we have to deal with it in human words, we assign words to these various functions of the soul. That which knows, we call the mind. That which feels, we call emotions. And that which wills or loves, we call the will or the heart. Now, actually, there's no such thing as a mind. There's no such thing as emotions. There's no such thing as a will. But we need these terms to describe functions, the ability to know, the ability to feel, and the ability to love. All right? I realize all this is a little bit tedious, but there is a point to it. The spiritual life has to do with the life of the mind, the emotions, and the will. That's all it is. I can't hammer this home enough. As such, in its basic connotation, spiritual life has nothing, in the beginning at least, to do with God. The spiritual life has to do with the development of the soul, or the anima, the psyche. Alright? Just as athletics, gym classes, training has to do with the development of the body or the material part of man. When the body is sick, we go to a hospital to get it patched up. When a boxer is in training for a fight, he goes through all kinds of exercises to develop the body. Now, that which has to do with the development of the soul, the mind, the emotions, the will, is called the spiritual life. In other words, when you hold a conversation, you are discussing intellectual concepts and ideas, and you are giving opinions and judgments, you talk about the weather, that's the development of spiritual life. When you read a book, you are developing the spiritual life. Oddly enough, when you plot a bank robbery, you are developing the spiritual life. You're not developing it too well, but I mean, it has to do with the use of the mind, the emotions, and the heart. Anything to do with the body is the material or physical life. Anything to do with the soul or the non-physical is the spiritual life. All right. Why does the mind exist to grasp truth? The mind is after truth. That's why we read books. That's why we study biology. That's why we study history. That's why we study anything, for the mind to grasp what is. Truth is not what you believe it to be. Truth is when the mind grasps external reality. All right. The Greek philosophers, along with everybody that came after them, and probably a whole lot of people who went before them, were after what the mind hungers for. Knowledge, 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 knowledge. Truth, truth, truth. They believed, as do all men, that ultimately the mind is made to grasp truth itself, or the source of all truth. The mind is meant to grasp external being, to go after it and to know what it is. Now, cutting through a whole lot of red tape, we do believe, ultimately, that there is one being that explains all other beings, and when you come to a knowledge of that being, which we call M-Purus, or pure being, we have reached truth itself. Now, some men have chosen to call that being God. That's a label, that's a tag. Some call him Allah, some call him God, some call him the Great Spirit, some call him whatever. But the pursuit of truth itself is the ultimate goal of the spiritual life. to grasp truth with the mind, and to feel and to love it with the emotions and the will, ultimately. In fact, those who believe this way believe that that's what heaven is, an ultimate possession of truth and goodness itself. Some of us choose to call this being, truth itself, God. So ultimately, my friends, the goal of the spiritual life is the pursuit of God in a very generic way. And it is the goal of every single individual human mind. Now that, basically, I think, in very simple language, is what the spiritual life is all about. Now, I know I'm repetitious, but I also know this, that repetition really is the mother of learning. The development of the body is called the physical life. The development of the soul is the development of the non-physical life, the development of the mind, the emotions, and the will. The spiritual life, ultimately, is the pursuit of truth, or knowledge of anything the mind is capable of grasping, which ultimately is truth itself, the supreme being, pure being, or, again, for want of a better word, God. The Greek philosophers, without benefit of divine revelation, God revealing himself, came to believe many, many things about God that they came to through a grasp of things that are graspable, and they came to believe that he is supreme being, that he is intelligent, and that he himself has a mind, emotions, and will. And again, these are just human terms to try to describe the indescribable. And so they set out with their minds and their hearts to gain some sort of knowledge and love of the supreme being. So basically, the spiritual life is the pursuit of a love affair with God. Okay? Now, what's all this business of religion? This thing that poses such a threat to people. This thing that many, especially a lot of recovered alcoholics, shy away from because you go into churches and they're loaded with hypocrites and, you know, all of that sort of nonsense. What is religion? Religion is nothing more than groups of people who make the spiritual life specific so that they can live it in community. Subjectively, religion, the word religion, means a virtue residing in the human heart whereby a person resolves to render unto God the things that are God's. Those of you in LA in your 11th step, pray for a knowledge of his will and the power to carry that out. When you pray for a knowledge of God's will and the power to carry that out, you are indeed living the personal virtue of religion. Religion is nothing more than the virtue of justice applied to God. You know what the virtue of justice is? Quid pro quo. I render unto you the things that are yours, and you render unto me the things that are mine. Bluntly, it is rendering unto Caesar, or mankind, what belongs to Caesar. When I take that virtue, which means respecting the rights of others, and apply it to God, that's what I mean by religion, rendering unto God the things that are God's. That is subjective or personal religion. Now, objectively, what's the definition of religion? I think it is easy if you simply remember that religion is a combination of three C's, just like the three C's in counseling. Religion is composed of three C's. Religion is a group of people, all who function under the same code, creed, and cult. Creed, they all believe the same truths about God, about themselves, and about their relationship with God. And so, we Catholics, for example, have what we call the Apostles' Creed, a set of truths that we hold that goes back to the days of the Apostles. The Nicene Creed, nothing but a ramification of that. Everybody has, every religious group has a set of truths that they all believe in. This is the first thing that unites a group of human beings. The second thing is code. They all function according to a single moral code because the common good is involved. And most people who belong to any branch of Christianity, the same with the Jewish people, They all accept the Ten Commandments that God handed down. This is the code of morality under which they function. And then we come to the last C, cult. They worship together. They worship together. Now, it is obvious then that if the spiritual life is a very general pursuit of God, any specific given religion is spelling it out in specific terms. In other words, a religion is nothing but a logical conclusion of the spiritual life. Now, why should it be logical? Why do religions make sense? Well, from the beginning of mankind, every group of people, man, by the way, from the beginning, is a social animal. He is gregarious. The word gregarious comes from a Latin word grex, gregis, which means herd. Man, like a whole lot of other animals, functions as a group, a herd. In fact, when we speak of people who make egregious mistakes, they are doing things that ordinary people don't do. It is egregious. It is eccentric. It is off the center. It is out of the group. Okay, man functions according to the group simply because he's not perfect. Some human beings have what I don't have. I have what other human beings don't have. And if you get a couple of 100,000 people together like that, maybe they can rule and govern themselves and so on. This is what government is all about. To have a people, or to say that you don't believe in religion, the only logical conclusion would be that you shouldn't believe in government. If you're going to be independent in your pursuit of God, you should also be independent in the governing of yourself. Government and religion have nothing more to say than we are functioning as a unit in our relationship with God, we are functioning as a unit in our relationship with man. It's the most logical thing that there is. From the beginning, every grex or herd or group or family or tribe of men has always had some sort of formal religion, whether they practice it or not, whether there are individuals who live by it or not. There has never in the history of humankind, never has there been found a group of people without a religion. Never. Now this must say something. My friends, if the human mind is formed for truth, the consensus of human opinion simply can't be wrong when from the beginning of time, all men have backed up the validity of religion. What is religion all about? It means that there are safeguards. It means that there is a unity of thinking, there is a unity of functioning, and there is a unity of worship. Now, how do we reconcile all of that with this business of my own personal individual mind is made for God, and in the next breath you're telling me I have to pray with and worship with other men? Well, again, it isn't a question of either or, it's a question of both. I happen to be an individual. I happen to have a name. I happen to have a vocation. I happen to be a priest, of course. But as an individual, my mind is made for my own personal pursuit of God, but as a member of society and as a member of humanity, I am meant also to do it with other human beings. And so I do both. When I wake up in the morning, I say my own personal morning prayers. As a priest, I have other prayers that I am obligated to say. There is such a thing as personal meditation. There is such a thing as my saying my night prayers alone. But there is also, and this is expressed in the will of God, He wishes to be worshipped corporately by people at a given time. And so He says, keep holy the Sabbath day, for those of you who are concerned about such things. And so we gather together and worship. Let me show you how AA itself beautifully illustrates this. In many areas, people will gather for an AA meeting. This proves the social nature of man. The very phenomenon of AA was people helping people together. And so they gather for meetings. Isn't this what you say to new people? Come to meetings, come to meetings, come to meetings, come to meetings. When we gather, many say this, many chairmen, all right, the meeting is about to begin. Let's take a moment of silent meditation. And here, each individual mind and heart makes its own contact with God, prepares self as an individual to take part in the meeting, right? When the meeting is all over, everyone rises, and he says, with those who care to, join us in the Lord's Prayer. And in many areas, there is a beautiful, beautiful practice of joining hands to become a unit, and we pray together. Obviously, people have to pray together because it's a crowd. You can't have a Tower of Babel. And so we memorize a prayer, as those who believe in Christianity believe that the Lord gave us, and we cite together the Lord's Prayer. It is a beautiful illustration of people who worship individually and corporately. Now, let's get back to religion and the practice of religion. You hear people say, well, I mean, I don't go to church anymore because I don't get anything out of it. Gimme, 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 have you got? Gimme, gimme, gimme. They haven't the foggiest notion that the virtue of religion is rendering unto God what we owe him. It doesn't have anything to do with what you feel like. It has to do with paying a debt. We go to church to give. We go to church to corporately pay homage to the God who created us. And for those of you who are recovered alcoholics, doesn't it only make sense that you go there to pay homage to the God who gave you the priceless gift of your sobriety? It, of course, it reflects an absolutely infantile attitude. It also reflects great, great ignorance of one of the greatest influences in our lives. Isn't it amazing how we prepare for everything except God and the things of God? Suddenly we're all alone again. I'll do it my way. It isn't God as we understand him. Very often it's God as we manufacture him. And so people, many, many people haven't the foggiest concept of why they go to church. I'm going to church to pay a debt. I owe him, intellectually, I owe him an acknowledgement of the fact that he's my creator. And I do this in company with other human beings. I compare going to church with paying your phone bill. If you get a kick out of it, that's great. But you don't have to get a kick out of it. Just pay it. Just pay it. Religion is nothing more than the virtue of justice rendered unto God. We speak of gratitude. We speak of what we owe him. He's given us a good set of parents. He's given us a wonderful life. He's given us a good job. He's given us good health. We speak of gratitude, and yet we never pay the debt. If a man comes to my backyard and puts in a swimming pool, I better have a check for him. If a man transfers an automobile over to me, I better have a check to pay for it. And yet I never, ever think what I actually owe God for what he has done for me. There is a debt, and he's going to ask payment one day. I think he wants us to give it willingly and lovingly here on earth. Now, what's all this business of atheism and agnosticism and everything? Well, the Greek word for God is theos, and the study of God is theos logos, or theology. In English, if we wish to make something negative, we say in or un or non. It's an unprofitable venture. Well, that was a very non-intelligible statement and so on. The Greeks, when they want to make something negative, they have the letter A, or alpha. They call it the alpha privative. It makes something negative. So, a theist, obviously, is somebody who believes in God. An atheist is somebody who doesn't. He said there's no God. All right. What does agnostic mean? The Greek word to know is gnosko. To be unable to know, to not know, is agnostic. Agnosko, to make it negative. All right. I've heard many, many people come into AA and they want to try to say that they're atheists, but they heard someone else use this big word, agnostic. And that sounds great, so they jump up and say, my name is Joe Dokes, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm agnostic. I don't believe in God. Agnostics have a very strong belief in God. The agnostic says, yes, there is a God. I have no doubt there is a God, but he's infinite, I'm finite. It is impossible to know anything about him. So let him live his life and I'll live mine. I am an agnostic. I believe in God, but I don't believe we can know anything about him. That's what agnosticism is all about. I would guess that there are atheists, and I would guess that there are agnostics. But mostly I think it's people who are just afraid of God. And I think in the AA community you find a lot of people who begin in atheism and they begin in agnosticism and then they come to believe a lot of things about this God. What can we know about this God? Well, the Greeks came to a knowledge of God. And the great St. Thomas Aquinas, who was probably a Christian Greek, he was a Greek by thought, but he was a Christian by persuasion, Thomas maintained that there were five proofs for the existence of God using only human reason. In other words, it is believed by many intellectuals in the human community that we can arrive at some knowledge of God purely through reason. Then we have the phenomenon of divine revelation, in which there are those of us who do believe that God himself revealed a few things about himself to us that we could not have known if he had not revealed. Our scripture, for example, is the great God revealing to man phenomenon. And so we can know a lot of things about this God. And I believe that as one becomes weller and weller and weller, by living the non-physical or spiritual principles of AA, that they can learn a very great deal about God. A very great deal. And I think that if they learn God properly, they will not confuse AA with their given chosen religion. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Wilson once made the statement that if alcoholism, well, now he didn't use these actual words, but I'll get to them in a minute. If alcoholism is sickness of body, mind, emotion, and soul, sobriety is its opposite, the recovery of health, a restoration to health of body, mind, emotion, and soul. Bill himself said that the answer to alcoholism is purely spiritual, non-physical, non-physical. And so he reached out to the religions of the day, and I wish that those of you who look down on religion would realize that that's exactly where your 12 steps came from. They reached out to the religions of the day, seeking help. They accepted everything offered, they kept what worked and threw out what didn't. And they came up with this magnificent, brilliant thing, the 12 steps of AA, that Christians have been living for centuries. For centuries. But Bill Wilson said this, whatever you were before you started to drink, you should be a better one after you get sober, or you're just not sober. In other words, my friends, to get well right, you have to get well all over. And one of our normal human relationships is our relationship with the divine. And I think that if your family relationship should clear up, and your social relationships clear up, and your job relationships clear up, your wife and children tolerate you now, you are now invited and accepted into homes and at affairs that you were not welcome at before, and your boss now has tremendous confidence in you, etc., 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 don't you think that your relationship with God should clear up? Don't you think you should get back to or seek to find some corporate relationship with God? And it is not AA. Bill Wilson and all of the founding fathers became horribly embarrassed when AA people began to substitute meetings for their religious faith. AA doesn't pretend to be your marriage counselor. AA doesn't pretend to be your doctor. AA doesn't pretend to be your dentist or your car repairman. AA promises and gives two things only. They say we will make you sober and we will keep you sober if you fulfill the conditions. Anything else, go get help wherever. I know a man who says, he's an AA man, he says, if you find me in an automobile accident, for God's sake, don't get me to a meeting, get me to an emergency room. AA doesn't pretend to be a hospital or a doctor, and AA doesn't pretend to take the place of your religion. AA is horribly embarrassed when any of its sons or daughters do this. So I guess the only thing I can leave you with is, you know, again, the basic thoughts. Spirituality and religion are not diametrically opposed. One, formal religion, is nothing but a specification and a fulfillment of spirituality in general. AA, knowing that the alcoholic has been damaged all over, says, if you stay away from alcohol, your body will begin to repair. If you stay sober, your family, job, and social life should improve. If you stay sober, I will reopen to you the gateway to God. It's up to you to pursue it. I will indeed patch up your spiritual life. It is up to you to patch up your religious life. And please don't condemn the good souls who never got into alcoholism and have been going to church every Sunday. How would you know they're hypocrites if you're not there with them? If you haven't been to church in 20 years, how do you know what type of people go there? Isn't it amazing how snobbish the have-not becomes? Many alcoholics, from their exalted position in the gutter, look down their noses at the people on the sidewalk who have prayed to this God in their churches on Sunday for the grace of recovery for many of us who got well. Let's rejoin the ranks of normal human beings. Walk with them hand in hand into the churches and let the world know that we have indeed recovered. Thank you for listening to me.